Greetings all. So, we're midway through the second chapter in Essays on the Gita, originally titled The Teacher, the Disciple, and the Doctrine, retitled when it came out in book form, 1923, as The Divine Teacher. I think it's rather straightforward what he's been saying in both the first chapter and the first part of this second chapter, and that what we're looking to from the Gita is an actual living inspiration, something that will empower our internal search to live from the soul and to live a well-concording life that brings us into harmony with society and nature outside and helps carry forward humanity in its quest for perfection. Perhaps elusive, but that is our direction. Sri Aurobindo, in presenting to us what essentially is the divine teacher to our grasp, provides a continuation of what he spoke about, wrote about in the Synthesis of Yoga, that the real teacher, the real guru, the one who has weight, who has substance, doesn't simply come with a message, with instruction, but lives it, has the power of the example that enforces the teaching. And more, that there is a potent influence that flows from that teacher. So Krishna is an important personage in the whole cast of characters in the Mahabharata, but he is not the dominant figure. He plays a pivotal, an often unseen role. And he leads both from above, a transcendent consciousness which has nevertheless manifested as a human. He leads from within the structure of society, and he also leads from within the heart of the seeker. So this teacher is, in a sense, omnipresent. Above, acting in the cosmos in a way that ineluctably leads towards its chosen goal. And we, in participating and manifesting a growing oneness with this supreme teacher, help to achieve the completion of the cosmic task. So Sri Aurobindo will again assert in a paragraph or so that we are not here to look for the historical significance of Krishna. We will, as we go through Essays on the Gita, occasionally talk about history. We will talk about how old the Gita is, etc., how many commentaries have been written about it, which ones get to the core of the message. I think we are fortunate to have Sri Aurobindo's essays because for a millennium, before he wrote his commentary, the thrust of the Gita had been buried in symbolism, in allegories, etc. Sri Aurobindo brings us back to a clear picture of the scene of the action, that this Kurukshetra is a constant moment All of us is engaged in just such a moment. If we attend to it with full consciousness, we'll come out well on the other side of it. But attaining that consciousness means not being seduced and deceived by the appearances, but living from a deeper stream of awareness. So let's pick up Sri Aurobindo's essay on the divine teacher, as we have it, with this paragraph. In seeking the kernel of the thought of the Gita, we need, therefore, only concern ourselves with the spiritual significance of the human divine Krishna of the Mahabharata, who is presented to us as the teacher of Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. The historical Krishna, no doubt, existed. We meet the name first in the Chandogya Upanishad, where all we can gather about him is that he was well known in spiritual tradition as a knower of the Brahman, so well known indeed in his personality and the circumstances of his life that it was sufficient to refer to him by the name of his mother as Krishna, son of Devaki, for all to understand who was meant. So this section in the Chandogya is interestingly on the nature of sacrifice, in what it is that we do to derive soma. Soma is delight. So if a rendering in English would be helpful, let me give you the location. It's in the Chandogya Upanishad. 3:17:6 is where specifically Krishna is mentioned. But I'm going to start a little bit above to show you what comprehensive picture of life the Chandogya envisioned. And remember, he's speaking here about the nature of the sacrifice, the commerce, the giving of the human to the divine, and the return of the divine to the human with blessings. When a man is hungry, thirsty, and without pleasures, that is his sacrificial consecration. And when he eats, drinks, and enjoys pleasures, by that he performs the preparatory rites. When he laughs, feasts, and has sex, by that he sings the chants and performs the recitations. Austerity, generosity, integrity, non-injury, and truthfulness, these are his gifts to the priests. Therefore, they say, he will press the soma. He has pressed the soma for himself. That is indeed his regeneration. The bath after the sacrifice is simply his death. After Gora Angirasa had taught the same thing to Krishna, the son of Devaki, he continued, he was then altogether free from desires and at the point of death. Quote, one should turn to these three for protection. You are the undecaying. You are the imperishable. You are fortified by breath, prana. End quote. In this connection, there are these two rig verses. Then they see the morning light of the primeval seed, the light that gleams from beyond the sky. Far beyond the surrounding darkness, we see the highest light. We see the highest light. To the God of gods, to the supreme solar light, to the sun, we have gone. So this is a picture of a Krishna, the son of Devaki, who has completed successfully the rounding out of life, who lives fully in the moment, fully as a human, engaged in nature, and yet has gone to the sun for delight. And what is the sun? What is the radiance of the sun? In the Vedic image, it is the honey of the gods. Turn all things to honey. Climb in consciousness. So back to Sri Aurobindo's essay. In the same Upanishad, we find mention of King Dhritarashtra, son of Vichitravirya, and since tradition associated the two together so closely that they are both of them leading personages in the action of the Mahabharata, we may fairly conclude that they were actually contemporaries, and that the epic is to a great extent dealing with historical characters, and in the war of Kurukshetra with a historical occurrence imprinted firmly on the memory of the race. Well, if you could help me on this, because I cannot find any mention of Dhritarashtra in the Chandogya Upanishad or in any of the commentaries around it, even in Max Müller going back to the 19th century. I can't find it in Sanskrit. So I'm not sure what text Sri Aurobindo was reading in this. So I call upon you for assistance. But his point is that there is historical connection to Krishna, that he seems to appear in the Chandogya Upanishad associated with Devaki. Now it is interesting when we come to later works, Puranic works, that they make no mention of the Chandogya Upanishad in this mention of Krishna. They go looking for later texts to gather information about Krishna. So that is not a clear indication either that they were part of this heritage, this spiritual heritage, which passed the Upanishads along from generation to generation. Were they so disengaged with that flow of the tradition that they had no knowledge of it? Or did they simply think, oh, that's a different Krishna? We don't have enough information, as often is the case in history, to speak to that clearly. Let's go forward. We know, too, that Krishna and Arjuna were the object of religious worship in pre-Christian centuries, and there is some reason to suppose that they were so in connection with the religious and philosophical tradition from which the Gita may have gathered many of its elements and even the foundation of its synthesis of knowledge, devotion, and works. And perhaps also that the human Krishna was the founder, restorer, or at the least one of the early teachers of this school. Taittiriya Brahmana has some interesting things to suggest in that. Have a look. The Gita may well, in spite of its later form, represent the outcome in Indian thought of the teaching of Krishna and the connection of that teaching with the historical Krishna, with Arjuna, and with the war of Kurukshetra, maybe something more than a dramatic fiction. In the Mahabharata, Krishna is represented both as the historical character and the avatar. His worship and avatarhood must therefore have been well established by the time, apparently from the 5th to the 1st centuries BC, when the old story and poem or epic tradition of the Bharatas took its present form. There is a hint also in the poem of the story or legend of the avatar's early life in Vrindavan, which, as developed by the Puranas into an intense and powerful spiritual symbol, has exercised so profound an influence on the religious mind of India. We have also, in the Harivansha, an account of the life of Krishna, very evidently full of legends, which perhaps formed the basis of the Puranic accounts. And the Harivansha is a sort of an appendix to the Mahabharata to sort of give us a prequel to say, oh, this is the context of Krishna, added hundreds of years after the composition of the Mahabharata, but felt to be relevant. We don't take the elements in the Puranas or in the Harivansha as being historical in and of themselves. But all this, though of considerable historical importance, But all this, though of considerable historical importance, has none whatever for our present purpose. We are concerned only with the figure of the divine teacher as it is presented to us in the Gita, and with the power for which it there stands in the spiritual illumination of the human being. So again, I call our attention back to the synthesis of yoga: instruction, example, influence. The Gita accepts the human avatarhood. For the Lord speaks of the repeated, the constant manifestation of the divine in humanity when he, the eternal unborn, assumes by his maya, by the power of the infinite consciousness, to clothe itself apparently in finite forms, the conditions of becoming, which we call birth. So if you go to the Gita, this would be detailed in chapter 4, verses 4 through 6, maybe even 4 through 8. And there's a footnote. And the first indeed represents verse 5, and the second, verse 8, in that fourth chapter. Note that what Sri Aurobindo says here about the nature of the manifestation of the divine in humanity, pressing himself as the Supreme Person upon his power of maya, he, the infinite, becomes apparently the finite. This is contra to the later school of Advaita Vedanta. Remember, the Gita in its composition, if it's from the first to the 5th century BCE, hard to know exactly where, but probably at least 200 BCE, then that's almost 1,000 years in advance of Shankara. So Shankara is dealing with a very different world and a very different philosophy. Krishna in the Gita, as we will see, is bringing back Vedanta to a point of action. Kurukshetra is a deliberate illustration of the importance of what it means to act spiritually in a world of strife, how to deal with division, as it were. Shankara's solution is to leave the world, to deny its reality. The Gita's is to affirm the reality of the world as a divine manifestation, and to insist again and again that Arjuna engage directly in life. But it is not this upon which stress is laid, but on the transcendent, the cosmic, and the internal divine. It is on the source of all things and the master of all, and on the Godhead secret in man. It is this internal divinity who is meant when the Gita speaks of the doer of violent asuric austerities, troubling the God within, or of the sin of those who despise the divine lodged in the human body, or of the same Godhead destroying our ignorance by the blazing lamp of knowledge. It is then the eternal avatar, this God in man, the divine consciousness always present in the human being, who manifested in a visible form, speaks to the human soul in the Gita, illumines the meaning of life and the secret of divine action, and gives it the light of the divine knowledge and guidance and the assuring and fortifying word of the master of existence in the hour when it comes face to face with the painful mystery of the world. So Krishna, indeed, as referenced above, declares to Arjuna rather early in the Gita, yes, we've been here before. We come again and again. Many are my lives that are past, and yours too, he says, that first quotation, Bahuni me vyatitani janmani. And then he says, essentially, for the deliverance of the good, for the destruction of the evildoers, for the enthroning of the right, dharma, I am born from age to age. But if you simply rely on that as your comfort and don't recognize and realize what is the divine and your identity with the divine, then your work will be fitful. The felicity that you experience will be elusive. You must realize these truths. They aren't real to you until you realize them. They are happy stories. You have to work. It's worth the work. It is this internal divinity who is meant. I'll read it again. When the Gita speaks of the doer of violent asuric austerities, troubling the God within, or of the sin of those who despise the divine lodged in the human body, or of the same Godhead destroying our ignorance by the blazing lamp of knowledge. It is then the eternal avatar, this God in man, the divine consciousness always present in the human being, who, manifested in a visible form, speaks to the human soul in the Gita, illumines the meaning of life and the secret of divine action, and gives it the light of the divine knowledge and guidance and the assuring and fortifying word of the master of existence in the hour when it comes face to face with the painful mystery of the world. So this appearance, this apocalypse of divine knowledge occurs at the moment you need it in life, on Kurukshetra itself, not away, sitting in meditation, isolated in a cave. You're there in the very throes of the struggle, and you awaken to it. And the divine has steered, engineered, guided you to a point where that can occur. Sometimes it occurs through the spoken word, when necessary, as when Arjuna hears from Krishna, and sometimes the Lord, Ishwara, can arrange it through a happy series of circumstances, a concatenation that leads you to it, and there's enough readiness in you that, there it is, now I see. But however it comes, it must come. This is what the Indian religious consciousness seeks to make near to itself in whatever form, whether in the symbolic human image it enshrines in its temples, or in the worship of its avatars, or in the devotion to the human guru, through whom the voice of the one world teacher makes itself heard, Jagadguru. Remember, go back to the synthesis of yoga. All teachers who have something authentic about them are voices, figurings of the one teacher. There's only one teacher leading the world, and 1,000 ways to hear the message. And they're all good if you hear them well. Through these, it strives to awaken to that inner voice, unveil that form of the formless, and stand face to face with that manifest divine power, love, and knowledge. There we go. The three united. Power. Karma Yoga. Love. Bhakti Yoga. Knowledge. Jnana Yoga. The divine leads you to oneness through all three aspects of your being. When they're all complete, the divine makes namaste to you, offers its namaskar. Secondly, there is the typical, almost the symbolic significance of the human Krishna who stands behind the great action of the Mahabharata, not as its hero, but as its secret center and hidden guide. That action is the action of a whole world of men and nations, some of whom have come as helpers of an effort and result by which they do not personally profit. And to these, he is a leader. Some as its opponents, and to them he also is an opponent, the baffler of their designs and their slayer. And he seems, even to some of them, an instigator of all evil and destroyer of their old order and familiar world and secure conventions of virtue and good. Some are representatives of that which has to be fulfilled. And to them, he is counselor, helper, friend. So, helpers, opponents, representatives. Remember Sri Aurobindo in the Alipur jail. Already he has realized the featureless Brahman. He sits in Brahmic awareness and he is invited by Krishna to come into an awareness of the omnipresent person. And as he comes to see Vasudeva everywhere, he sees him in the faces of his enemies. He sees them impersonally in the walls, in the ants, and the personages of his fellow prisoners. In fact, wherever he throws his glance, he sees only that divine. And then he is at ease. Then he can be at peace and knows that all will come out well. It's been promised, just as Arjuna has been told, you will be victorious. You have been given the divine weapon that will slay your enemies. You cannot lose. We'll come to that occasion, not far from now. But this sentence, I think, harkens back to Sri Aurobindo's own experience. Where the action pursues its natural course, or the doers of the work have to suffer at the hands of its enemies and undergo the ordeals which prepare them for mastery, the avatar is unseen or appears only for occasional comfort and aid, but at every crisis his hand is felt, yet in such a way that all imagine themselves to be the protagonists. And even Arjuna, his nearest friend and chief instrument, does not perceive that he is an instrument, and has to confess at last that all the while he did not really know his divine friend. He has received counsel from his wisdom, help from his power, has loved and been loved, has even adored without understanding his divine nature. But he has been guided, like all others, through his own egoism, and the counsel, help and direction have been given in the language and received by the thoughts of the ignorance. Chapter 11, Shloka 41, by the way. until the moment when all has been pushed to the terrible issue of the struggle on the field of Kurukshetra, and the avatar stands at last, still not as fighter, but as the charioteer in the battle car which carries the destiny of the fight. He has not revealed himself even to those whom he has chosen. This is the full figure of something which is carried in Buddhistic thought as always using skillful means. Communicate in the way that is necessary to your audience. What language do they speak? You speak that language. How can they receive that message delivered in that manner? But here we see that Krishna, a transcendent, universal, and even individual figure, is guiding all through their own ways. You remember Sri Aurobindo and the mother speaks about how she, the Mahashakti, guides us through our own nature, through our own limitations, according to the modes of our ignorance, so to speak, to a divine goal. Thus, the figure of Krishna becomes, as it were, the symbol of the divine dealings with humanity. Through our egoism and ignorance, we are moved, thinking that we are the doers of the work, vaunting of ourselves as the real causes of the result, and that which moves us we see only occasionally as some vague or even some human and earthly fountain of knowledge, aspiration, force, some principle or light or power, which we acknowledge and adore without knowing what it is until the occasion arises that forces us to stand arrested before the veil. Do you remember the Kena Upanishad, where the gods are very happy about having put down the asuras? They've beaten them. And Brahman is sitting at some distance watching and say, oh, they think they have won the victory. And they're preening themselves. And then he appears before them. And they see this mighty spirit, this yaksha. And they don't know who he is. And so Agni approaches first. The god of the mystic fire. I don't know if we should run through the whole thing at this point. But the point is that every divinity which thinks it has done this task, been the doer of the deed, is forced to concede its ignorance and cannot ascertain, know, who is this figure, because it is beyond all. It seems to be a spirit, but it is everything. We'll come back to this. And the action in which this divine figure moves is the whole wide action of man in life, not merely the inner life, but all this obscure course of the world, which we can judge only by the twilight of the human reason as it opens up dimly before our uncertain advance, the little span in front. This is the distinguishing feature of the Gita, that it is the culmination of such an action which gives rise to its teaching and assigns that prominence and bold relief to the gospel of works, which it enunciates with an emphasis and force we do not find in other Indian scriptures. True, not even later in the Tantras. Not only in the Gita, but in other passages of the Mahabharata, we meet with Krishna declaring emphatically the necessity of action, but it is here that he reveals its secret and the divinity behind our works. We'll come back to the context of the Gita and the very scene of Kurukshetra shortly. The symbolic companionship of Arjuna and Krishna, the human and the divine soul, is expressed elsewhere in Indian thought. In the heavenward journey of Indra and Kutsa, seated in one chariot, in the figure of the two birds upon one tree in the Upanishad, in the twin figures of Nara and Narayana, the seers who do tapasya together for the knowledge. So let's pause. Indra and Kutsa, you'll find that in Rig Veda 4:16:11 and also in 5:29:9. The two birds upon one tree, Mundaka Upanishad 3:1:1, Shvetashvatara Upanishad 4:6. Nara and Narayana, well, we find that in the very opening parva section in the Mahabharata, Adi Parva. And of course, we find it later in lots of Puranic works. But in all three, well, let me also mention Bhagavad Gita 4:33. But in all three, it is the idea of the divine knowledge in which, as the Gita says, all action culminates, that is in view. Here, it is instead the action which leads to that knowledge and in which the divine knower figures himself, Arjuna and Krishna, this human and this divine, stand together not as seers in the peaceful hermitage of meditation, but as fighter and holder of the reins in the clamorous field, in the midst of the hurtling shafts, in the chariot of battle. The teacher of the Gita is therefore not only the God in man who unveils himself in the word of knowledge, but the God in man who moves our whole world of action, by and for whom all our humanity exists and struggles and labors, towards whom all human life travels and progresses. He is the secret master of works and sacrifice, and the friend of the human peoples. So, in Bhagavad Gita, 10th chapter, 22nd verse, among the virtues and vibhutis that he says speak best of him, among the gods, he says, I am Vasava, Indra. But he is also every individual. And as you can see, here in this last couple of sentences, Sri Aurobindo again stresses that this transcendent, the supreme person, Purushottama, is here in the cosmic scene and at the very core of each individual. So those three terms of existence that Sri Aurobindo treats in the life divine and the synthesis of yoga, the transcendent, the cosmic, and the individual, very much at play, coincident throughout the teaching of the Gita, because it is here at that hour, Kurukshetra, all of it comes into full flower in this teaching, in this revelation. So next time we take up the human disciple. Tonight, if you're with me still, let's read, I think you are, yes? Let's read from Savitri. Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. Canto 4, the Secret Knowledge. This is towards the bottom of page 66. The master of existence lurks in us and plays at hide and seek with his own force. In nature's instrument loiters secret God. The immanent lives in man as in his house. He has made the universe his pastime's field, a vast gymnasium of his works of might. All-knowing, he accepts our darkened state. Divine wears shapes of animal or man. Eternal, he assents to fate and time. Immortal, dallies with mortality. The all-conscious ventured into ignorance. The all-blissful bore to be insensible. Incarnate in a world of strife and pain, he puts on joy and sorrow like a robe and drinks experience like a strengthening wine. He whose transcendence rules the pregnant vasts, prescient now dwells in our subliminal depths, a luminous individual power alone. The absolute, the perfect, the alone, has called out of the silence his mute force, where she lay in the featureless and formless hush, guarding from time by her immobile sleep the ineffable puissance of his solitude. The absolute, the perfect, the alone, has entered with his silence into space. He has fashioned these countless persons of one self. He has built a million figures of his power. He lives in all who lived in his vast alone. Space is himself, and time is only he. The absolute, the perfect, the immune, one who is in us as our secret self, our mask of imperfection has assumed. He has made this tenement of flesh his own, his image in the human measure cast, that to his divine measure we might rise. Then, in a figure of divinity, the Maker shall recast us and impose a plan of Godhead on the mortal's mold, lifting our finite minds to his infinite, touching the moment with eternity. This transfiguration is earth's due to heaven. A mutual debt binds man to the supreme. His nature we must put on as he put ours. We are sons of God and must be even as he. His human portion, we must grow divine. Our life is a paradox with God for key. But meanwhile, all is a shadow cast by a dream, and to the musing and immobile spirit, life and himself don the aspect of a myth, the burden of a long, unmeaning tale. For the key is hid, and by the inconscient kept. The secret God beneath the threshold dwells. In a body obscuring the immortal spirit, a nameless resident, vesting unseen powers with matter, shapes, and motives beyond thought and the hazard of an unguessed consequence, an omnipotent, indiscernible influence, he sits, unfelt by the form in which he lives, and veils his knowledge by the groping mind. A wanderer in a world his thoughts have made, he turns in a chiaroscuro of error and truth to find a wisdom that on high is his. As one forgetting, he searches for himself. As if he had lost an inner light, he seeks. As a sojourner lingering amid alien scenes, he journeys to a home he knows no more. His own self's truth he seeks. Who is the truth? He is the player who became the play. He is the thinker who became the thought. He is the many who was the silent one. In the symbol figures of the cosmic force, and in her living and inanimate signs, and in her complex tracery of events, he explores the ceaseless miracle of himself, till the thousandfold enigma has been solved in the single light of an all-witnessing soul. Namaste, Jai Ma.